Verse 40 through 56. Luke 8, 40 through 56. The lesson tonight is going to begin well. It may deteriorate as I go along. You get used to doing a thing a certain way, and then all of a sudden you can't do it that way anymore, and it just becomes very difficult. And I'm used to doing everything at the keyboard, and usually put it in during the week, and at the last minute you pull it together in the form that you want it to be. And that's what I usually do on Wednesday for the study on Wednesday night. But Jane lost her system today. I lost my system today just to turn it on and on doesn't do anything. So I had to do what I haven't done for years. I had to write. And I don't know whether I can follow through these notes or not. I'll try. But if I stumble, you'll know that the stumbling is very real, because I had to make an adjustment that I've been away from for about 4 years, and that's very, very difficult. It's like moving a light switch or a bunch of light switches. You're used to going here without looking, and now you don't know where to go, and you fumble and so forth. So I hope I've made adequate excuse if the lesson is a bit on the sad side. Hopefully it won't be. We're looking now at Luke 8, verse 40 through 56. And we need to come into that with a little bit of an introduction. And that is, this portion is unusual because it contains two miracles. Ordinarily, you would simply handle the first miracle, then Luke would narrate the second miracle, and you would handle it that way. There's a problem here, however. And the problem involved is, these two miracles are intertwined. They are not given in sequence. In both Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you can see that they're intertwined. Intertwined, misspelled here. They're intertwined. So that, and let's begin reading at chapter 8 and you'll see what I mean. Chapter 8 and verse 40. And as Jesus returned, the multitude welcomed him, for they'd all been waiting for him. And behold, there came a man named Jairus. Now this is the beginning of the first miracle. Behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was an official of the synagogue. And he fell at Jesus' feet and began to entreat him to come to his house. For he had an only daughter, about 12 years old, and she was dying. So with that point, the Lord takes off to go to his house. And the next sentence says, as he went, the multitudes were pressing against him, and a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and could not be healed by anyone came up behind him, etc., etc. And we have her healing and his dealing with her down through verse 48. Then in verse 49, while he was still speaking to her, someone comes to the house of the synagogue official saying, the daughter of the man that you just met has already died. You don't need to come down. And he proceeds on the journey. So you have two miracles that are intertwined. One interrupts the other, but at the same time, they are still distinct and separate. One of them has to do with a restoration to life. And that's what makes it distinct. It's a restoration to life. The second one is a healing. And that means they're unique to themselves. They're distinct from one another. They are not the same. Different people are involved. Different situation is involved. Different results are involved. Different problem was involved. So they're unique in every sense of the word. But they're intertwined. Now let me show you how they're intertwined. They're intertwined in this way, and this will be our outline that we'll use tonight. Number one, you have the first miracle introduced. This is where we really need to see how it's put together. We'll miss the thrust here. The first miracle introduced, chapter 8, 40 through 42a. And that's where the man approaches Jesus, says, my daughter's dying, and the Lord begins to go And he is then, number two, first miracle interrupted. First miracle introduced, 40 through 42a. And now that first miracle is interrupted in 8:42b. 8:42b says, as he begins to go toward this man's house, that as he went, the multitudes were pressing against him. And that's going to interrupt his progress. Third, you come to 42b, and that is where, or 43, that's where the woman who had a hemorrhage comes up and touches his garment. So you now have the second miracle performed. And that is 8:43 through 48. Then, in 49 through 46, we go back and we have the first miracle performed. And that is in 8:49 through 56. So notice again the intertwined structure. First miracle gets introduced, then the first miracle gets interrupted, and the second gets performed, and then we loop back and we perform the first miracle. So simply following that as we look through these verses, that there are two, and yet they are very, very much intertwined, or we could put it this way. This is saying, while Jesus was en route to perform a miracle, he performed a miracle en route. That helped clarify. Verses 40 through 42, he was en route to perform a miracle, and while en route, he performs another miracle, and then arrives and performs the first miracle that was introduced at the beginning of the journey. Or, put it one other way, Jesus performed a miracle while en route, and he performed another upon arrival. And that is our first point, then, of introduction to Luke 8, 40 through 56. It deals with two miracles. Second point of introduction is the transition from the event of Luke 8, 26 through 39 is striking, very striking. And I'll show you why in just a moment. What is the event in 8:26 through 39? We studied it last time. Verse 26, he leaves Capernaum, sails across the Sea of Galilee, and we read, they sail to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when he had come out of this land, he was met by a certain man from the city who was possessed with demons. And we went through how this man is healed, how the demon is cast out, and that narrative continues down for through 39. So the event of Luke 8, 26 through 39 is casting out demons in Gadara, or among the Gerasenes. And then in verse 40, we transition over to the other side of the lake. He sailed back again. He's over near Capernaum, and you have the event with the multitude there meeting him. And the transition is striking in this way. And you see the striking nature of it if you go to first the narrative of 8:37 and compare it with 8:41. In 8:37, he's in Gadara. He's among the, or Gerasa, rather. In 41, he has now returned to Capernaum. Two different events on opposite sides of the Sea of Galilee. Now, here is the contrast. In Gerasa, look at verse 37. All the people of the country, the Gerasenes and the surrounding district, focus here, ask him to depart. He was asked to leave. However, look down in 8:41. And behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was an official of the synagogue, fell at Jesus' feet and began to entreat him to come. Asked to leave, and now asked to come. And so the whole attitude of the people among whom he worked was totally different. Gerasa, get out of here. Capernaum, come down to my house. Opposite request. The interesting thing is that Jesus responded to both. Gerasa said, leave, and he left. Capernaum said, come, and he came. And it's interesting to see that response through that. So when Jesus was asked to depart, he departed. When he was asked to come, he came. Okay, now we can start our outline. First miracle introduced. First miracle introduced. 8:40-42. And we have first the return and second the request. First the return to Capernaum, 8:40. And the first thing we can focus on is the crowd. Number one, its attitude. The attitude of the crowd is the first thing that Luke focuses on, chapter 8, verse 40. And as Jesus returned, that is, back to Capernaum again, the multitude or the crowd welcomed him. And so the word to focus on is the word welcomed. He moved from a hostile crowd now to a welcome crowd. And since we did a little Greek on Sunday, the word welcome is an aorist tense. Remember, aorist tense refers to a definite event. Here it would be the welcoming event. And it also says, think of the what happened, not when. Emphasis is on what happened, not when it happened. And therefore, when you come into verse 40 and says the multitude or the crowd welcomed him, this was a welcoming event. We could almost say when the crowd held a welcome ceremony because of the aorist tense. And the text of the aorist tense also indicates don't think time, think event. And so he says something like this, if I could paraphrase it, and Jesus returned and the crowd welcomed him. Think of that. Think of what, it's not a hostile crowd. It's a welcoming committee. It's not a crowd that is against him. It's a crowd that is for him. And it sets in contrast to what had happened over on the other side of Galilee. So, if we could read it for emphasis, verse 40, Jesus returned and the multitude had a welcome event for him. And think about that. The crowd was not hostile. The crowd was a crowd that was willing to accept him. The second thing we know about this word welcomed is its meaning. And its meaning goes just a little bit different than simply welcome. Because the word was used in classical Greek in this way. It meant to accept a teacher. Accept as a teacher. Or to accept as an authority. Now that pours a little meaning, a little more meaning into the word, does it not? Because verse 40, the crowd on this side says, we accept you as our teacher. We accept you as an authority. It was also used in this way, and if you look in a classical lexicon, it would say this, to admit argument as valid. To admit arguments as valid. To admit arguments as valid. Now, if you kind of wrap that up and pour it into the verb there, then you can see why we've outlined, as Jesus returns to Capernaum, Luke is going to stress the attitude of the crowd. They had been waiting for him. They had anticipated him. They welcome him. They recognize him as a teacher. They recognize him as an authority. And they say, we believe that the arguments that you've been giving us are valid arguments. That's the attitude of the crowd. They welcomed him. Second thing to focus on is the expectation of the crowd. Attitude and now expectation. And that's found in the last part of verse 40 when it says they had all been waiting for him. And the key word there is waiting. Welcome and waiting. And the word waiting, we need to give what it does not mean. It is not a word referring to passing time. It doesn't mean passing time. It doesn't mean they were sitting around ho-hum, looking at their watches or whatever timepiece they may have had, pacing, walking back and forth, looking down the street for the bus, just passing time. That is not the idea of the word at all. It is a word that simply means eager anticipation. They eagerly anticipated his coming. So eager anticipation. Now then, verse 40, you can see what he's doing. He's coming into the transition away from hostile crowd to a crowd that says, we're waiting for you, we expect you, we believe you, we welcome you, it's a pleasure to have you back. We've been sitting here looking out over Galilee saying, maybe that's him, he's returning, and we believe your arguments are true, we believe you're a teacher, we believe your authority. That is the tone set in chapter 8, verse 40. Or let's summarize it in one sentence. In verse 40, Jesus arrives in Capernaum to meet a large, sympathetic, expectant crowd. Now, that return that he spent the time on in verse 40 is met with the request. The return is met with the request of Jairus. 8:41. And two things emerge in verse 41 about Jairus. Number one, we're told the position that he held. And number two, we have something about the man's humility. First, his position. And behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was an official. And that is the word to focus on. He was an official. Greek word, archon. In the synagogue, there was a group of men who were responsible for keeping order. They were called the archon. He was an archon. One responsible for synagogue order. For example, you did not speak in the synagogue unless one of these men gave you permission to speak in the synagogue. Many times when Paul in the book of Acts, as we went through that, you recall, would go in and the archon would say, Paul, we welcome you. You may speak to the synagogue. But he was one in authority. So this man was definitely a religious Jewish authority. Second, the focus is on his humility. And that's in the B part of verse 41. And let me tell you, this was a rare thing. You know how the synagogue leaders and the Jewish leaders responded to Jesus. They hated him. But here is an interesting exception because we see that this man fell at Jesus' feet. So falling at his feet, we'll just put falling, shows the respect that this man had for Jesus.
Can you imagine a Sadducee or Pharisee, as we know them in the New Testament, falling prostrate at Jesus' feet? And this man did. Thus, humility. It's another interesting thing to note in verse 41 that when this man falls at Jesus' feet, Jesus accepted the worship. He didn't say, get up. He accepted the homage. Now, in order to get the force of the, let me show you a couple of instances where it was refused, and rightly so. Look, for example, at the example of Peter in Acts chapter 10 and verse 26. And here you have a similar circumstance where one falls at the feet of Peter, and Peter says, get up, I'm only a man. Verse 25 of Acts 26, when it came about that Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet. That's the same action as is described over here in Luke 8. And worshipped him, but Peter, verse 26, raised him up saying, stand up, I am too just a man. But please note, when Jairus fell at the feet of Jesus, it does not say Jesus picked him up and said, stand up, I am just a man. Peter did, Jesus didn't. Another example is found in Revelation 19:10 by an angel and John 19:10. The angel appears to John. And in verse 9 of Revelation 19, the angel said to me, John, write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true words of God. And I, John, fell at his feet to worship him. And he said, do not do that. I am a fellow servant. And so the angel says, don't bow at my feet. I will not accept homage. Peter says, don't bow at my feet. I'm a man. I will not accept homage. But go back to Luke 8. And when the man falls at his feet and began to entreat him, the Lord does not say, get up. The Lord accepted worship. Who did Jesus think he was? He was who he was, the Son of God, and worship was appropriate, and worship was accepted. And that's just one of those little subtle things that is not the point of the text to teach that, but it is an interesting point, is it not, how Jesus accepted worship and thus acknowledged deity. Okay, we've had then the return to Capernaum, two, the request of Jairus, and now Luke says, let me give an explanation. So we have now the explanation of Luke. The return of Jesus, the request of Jairus, and now the explanation of Luke. And that is found in verse 42. One of the interesting things about the New Testament is, of all the writers, you can always write a little sketch of what kind of people they were. Luke, as you see him record the miracles, apparently was a very sensitive type person. Because in three places where you have a child healed, it is only Luke that says he was an only child. And notice coming down to verse 42, Luke adds his explanation. And it is an expression of tenderness. For it said he had an only daughter. And Luke, again, will center on that. He does that in two other contexts. No other writer is quite as tender and sensitive as Luke is. And little things like, this is the only child. And Luke identifies with that very strongly, does it three times, as ever against zero mentions of such a thing in Matthew or Mark. And it gives a little lead into the kind of character that Luke really was. And she was about 12. Critical age. Certainly a critical age in the Jewish mind. And I think 12, you could fairly say, is a critical age, just into adolescence, ready to go into adolescence. A very critical age. And imperfect tense. What's imperfect tense? An action going on continuously in past time. Remember? Here's one. She was in the process of dying. And the man had left home. And as he left home, he knew that if something didn't stop the process, the girl was going to die. All right, we now move to our second point of outline. First miracle now is going to get interrupted. That's as far as we get with this first miracle. So in your mind, back at the ranch, you've got the scene of the girl breathing her last, and you have the father that's come to Jesus. And the father has just said to Jesus, come to my house before she dies and you can do something for her. And Jesus begins to go in that direction. Jairus has got to be some hero. Have you ever been in a hurry to get someplace and someone has an accident on the freeway and you're in that lane? And what do you begin to do? You do the same thing I do. You begin to churn. You look at your watch. I'm going to be late. Can't you dump? And I think all kinds of, if it's on the Paseo Bridge, can't the wrecker just pick the stupid car up and throw it in the river and let the rest of us go on? And I probably, like most people, get very upset. You get, your stomach begins to burn. And how would you like it if Jesus said, I'll come down and heal your daughter? And this crowd of the mooing herd gets in the way and the Lord can't even move. Because that comes in the latter part of that verse, 42, that as he starts that way, there's a jam on the freeway and he can't get there. And then of all things, this woman touches him while my daughter's dying. This woman touches him and what does he do? He stops and says, who touched me? And you'd want to say, Jesus, would you please ask dumb questions later? We got to get moving. My daughter is dying. And I don't know what went on in the stomach of Jairus. Apparently nothing. He just seemed to be pretty relaxed about it. And then wouldn't you, can't you feel what the man felt when, as they finally got through the crowd, as Jesus finally got dealing with this woman, they began to go. Finally, the freeway opens up and they begin to go on their way. And here comes a servant down the road and says, sorry, too late. She's dead. So this is a really interesting narrative in the emotion of Jairus. And you can hardly blame the man if he'd become impatient and asked Jesus to hurry up or told the woman to get out of the way or pushed through the crowd, elbowed through the crowd or something. But he didn't do that. And even when the news comes that the child has died, the 12-year-old has died, Jairus still seems to have it together. So he must have been one great individual. Okay, the interruption now comes on with verse 42b. As he went, the multitudes were pressing against him. The word pressing is interesting because it's usually applied in a different way. The verb that is used here means to choke. It's what Strouds does with their chickens. We choke our chickens. And it was a word used of literally taking somebody around the neck and choke them. And metaphorically then, the crowd completely impeded and blocked his progress. He couldn't move. So we could translate accurately at that verse, 42b, as he went, the multitudes were choking him off. He couldn't move. He was pressed. Pressed, I guess, is a good translation there. So this explains two things. Number one, this explains, obviously, slow progress. It shows why he didn't make it in time. Explains why he was, and I'm going to put this in quotes, quote, end quote, late. Obviously late, the girl's dead. Didn't make it in time. It's too late. Second, it explains the woman's actions. Why she touched his garment. She couldn't do anything else. And we'll see some of the color that's involved as she touches the garment of Jesus. Now, with that, we have the second miracle performed. Second miracle is now going to be performed. And we're going to get three lessons in faith. First, her concealed faith. 8:43-44a. Reading verse 43. And a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and could not be healed by anyone came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. Stop there. That's concealed faith. We will follow in 44b with rewarded faith. And then, with the question of verse 45, we will focus on her revealed faith. First, concealed faith. And we stop first with her problem. What was the problem this woman had? First, physically. And let me tell you, her only problem was not physical. In fact, that was probably the minor part of her problem. But physically, we are told in verse 42:3 that she had a hemorrhage. Now, we don't know exactly what that is. Let me give you a literal. It says, being in flow. Being in flow. And that's as literal as you can get with the Greek word. If you take that word flow, rousse, and look at its usage and who uses it, you do find, and in the your various lexicons and resources for the Greek New Testament, you have the legal writers, you have the prose writers, the poetic writers, and you've got a significant body of medical writers. And in the medical writers, this word rousse is used for flow of blood. Hence, our translation, which is hemorrhage. Specifically, that's all we know. It was a flow of blood. Was it menstrual? We don't know. That seems to be the closest probability. But whatever it was a hemorrhage of some sort. But that wasn't her only problem. She also had a financial problem. Now, if you look down at chapter 8, verse 43, or verse 40, well, maybe it's in Mark. Look at Mark 9. Oh, no, verse 43, I'm sorry. Back to verse 43 of Luke. Notice down that it's the woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 and could not be healed by anyone. And then you've got in your margin off of that one, some manuscripts add who had spent all her living on physicians. And the word for living is bios, like in biology. And it's a word that was used over and over again for means of living. So if that textual variant is correct, she had spent all her means of living, means of survival, means of, in other words, she had lost her health and she had lost her wealth. But there's more to it than that. Not only did she have a physical problem, financial problem, but she also had a severe social problem. Because if she were married, as most Jewish women were, she could not live with her husband. She had to leave him. She could not move in public. She could not touch anybody. Go back to the book of Leviticus 15. She couldn't go to the temple. And I'll put socially and religiously right there with it. And I'm not separating those out because in Jewish life, the religious life, the social life among the fellow Israelites was one and the same. Leviticus chapter 15, verse 19. This woman was in deep trouble. Leviticus 15, verse 19. When a woman has a discharge, if her discharge in her body is blood, and by the way, I believe it's the Mark account that does add to the word flow, the word blood, so we know it was blood. When a woman has a discharge, if her discharge in her body is blood, she shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days. And whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. And then all the other regulations. So she could not touch Jesus. To be touched by someone in that condition was to be ceremonially unclean. So you can see the difficulty she was in, and let's go back to. Can you see why she seized on this opportunity? I can't speak to Jesus because I'm unclean. But you know, in this crowd, I could touch part of his garment and nobody would ever know. Can you imagine her horror when she touches it and the Lord stops and says, "Who touched me?" And big mouth, crude, rude, you know, crude, rude. Big mouth, crude, rude. Peter. You know, Peter, what's wrong with you? It's a crowd. You know, everybody's touching you. What do you mean someone touched you? Because remember, he's being pressed, choked by the crowd. And so you can imagine the horror when the Lord stopped and said, "Who touched me?" And she had already taken off because it said she came back. And when she came back, she was shaking, shaking all over. Because we read of how she returns a little bit later on, but nonetheless, focus at this point on her her condition. Okay, the problem, and now second, her touch. Her problem, her touch. 844a. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. Again, I don't know what kind of image you've got. I think most people picture Jesus as running around in something like a bathrobe. He dressed as a Jew would dress. And the outer cloak of the Jewish male dress was square at the bottom. And on each of the four corners, two in the front, two in the back, it had a tassel hanging down. This was required by the Old Testament. And therefore, when we come up to this, if you can picture the squared garment coming down maybe just below the knees and tassels hanging on the four corners. And she figures, you know, I could probably touch that tassel and nobody would ever know. Naturally, you wouldn't. And therefore, when you come to verse 44, it says she came up behind him and touched the tassel. Not fringe, but the tassel of his cloak. Now, every Jew was required to wear that. Go back to Numbers 15. Numbers 15. Every male Israelite was required to wear a squared outer garment with tassels on four corners. Numbers 15, 38. Verse 37 says, "The Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the sons of Israel, and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generation. That was a standing Jewish requirement. And they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of blue. Now you get a little bit better picture. Jesus has doubtless a light, probably white outer garment, comes down and it's square at the bottom, and there are blue tassels hanging down at the front, blue tassels at the back, and her thought is this: I'm unclean. But I think so much of this man, he is so powerful, and the crowd is so big, I bet I could run up there, I bet I could get a touch of that tassel. And again, she touches the tassel and a very dramatic thing happened. Her thought doubtless is, I can do this and nobody will ever know that I, an unclean woman, touched Jesus. And thus, her approach. Okay, that is concealed faith. That is followed by, two, rewarded faith. Rewarded faith. 8:44b. And immediately her hemorrhage stopped. I think you'll like the Greek. It says this literally: the flow. And the word histemi means to stand. The flow stood still. Immediately. So you can get the dramatic effect. She brushes the blue tassel, the rear of his garment, and instantly, like that, the flow stood still. It's almost a word, and it's a word that is used in context of someone snapping to attention. It's just as though the moment she touched his garment, the flow stood up and saluted and said, "Yes, sir," and stopped. And that's the drama that is found in this particular verse. As is typical, remember, of the miracles of Jesus, how much recuperation is required in the miracles of Jesus? None, ever. No recuperation period. They are always instantaneous. Remember when we went over the characteristics of miracles of Jesus. Third, revealed faith. Revealed faith. 8:45-48. And the first thing to note is this. Picture yourself in the last big, really big crowd you were in, where people were just jostling one another to get out. You put yourself in that situation. Now, as you're in that crowd, you stop and you say loudly, "Who touched me?" This guy's nuts. People are all over you. Well, wouldn't that be the case? What do we have back in verse 42? Last sentence. But as he went, the multitudes were choking against him. And so he asked, "Who touched me?" And so that calls, obviously, for some explanation. Peter probably nudged someone else and said, "He's lost it. Everybody's touching him." And Peter kind of rudely and crudely dismisses it. But the first thing to note here is this. Jesus understood the meaning of her touch. He understood the meaning of her touch. And number one, we can say this: he knew it was special. He knew it was special. How do we know that? Because he distinguished it from the hundreds of other touches. And the touch of this woman was understood differently, even though she was obviously behind him. and someone had bumped him on an arm and he didn't notice it, and someone else bumped him, and someone else bumped him, and someone else bumped him, and suddenly she touches the garment and he says, that's a different touch. That is special. The reason he understood it, it was a touch of faith. And you express faith toward him and he always recognizes the touch. That is always distinguished by him as it was in this particular context. Not only did he know it was special, he also knew it was purposeful. She did it for a reason. In other words, to make it antithetical, he knew that was an accidental bump. Lots of bumps in crowds are accidental. You didn't mean, and we say, excuse me, pardon me, as you edge your way through a crowd. But the Lord knew that this touch was not only special, but she had something in mind. You touched that tassel and you had something in your mind, didn't you? It was not an accident of being in a crowd. It was very special. Or, put it this way, he knew it was not the touch of a finger, but a touch of faith. It was not a touch of a finger. It was the touch of faith, and he knew it. Does this say anything about the omniscience of Jesus? Of all these people, how did he know that her mental attitude was one of believing when she touched not him, but the tassel of his garment? And he didn't even see her. How did he know that? Because he's the Son of God, and it's an evidence of his omniscience. So, Jesus understood the meaning of her touch. Two, the crowd did not understand the meaning of the touch. Crowd did not understand its meaning. And that's in the latter part of verse 45. And again, you've got to get the dramatic effect of this. It's just like stealing a pack of bologna and walking out the door, and you run head into a cop. It's just how way she, I thought I'd get by with this, and he stopped and says, who is the one who touched me? And while they were all denying it, Peter said, and this is really, really tasteful and sensitive of Peter, to tell the Lord that, well, the crowds are crowding and pressing upon you, Lord. Don't you know that? And it's sort of, a rude, crude statement on the part of Peter, but he was very capable of that. The crowd did not understand. The disciples, I don't want to say always, often may be even too weak, always too much, often maybe too weak. The disciples often missed spiritual truth. That was conveyed in Jesus' words. Let me show you that in John. Just a couple of places. Well, you don't have to go to it. Let me walk you through it. In John chapter 2, Jesus talked about destroying the temple. They interpreted that to be the literal temple. What was the spiritual truth behind the temple? His body and his resurrection. In John 3, he said you have to be born again. How did Nicodemus take it? How can I enter the second time into my mother's womb and be born? You missed it, Nicodemus. That's not what I'm talking about. You missed the spiritual truth. And chapter 4, at the well, the woman at the well, says, I can give you water to drink and you'll never thirst again. And she comes back, well, this well is deep. How can you do that? And she missed the whole spiritual significance. John chapter 6, he says that I am the bread of life. Whoever eats and partakes of me will have eternal life. And they say, are you a cannibal? How can we eat this man's flesh and drink his blood? And so forth. John 8 has an example, John 11, but that's simply an observation. Disciples often missed spiritual truth as Jesus spoke. Now, notice verse 46 does establish another point. Jesus said, "Someone did touch me, for I was aware that power had gone out of me." Now come to verse 48. He speaks to her and says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." What healed the woman? The Lord's power or her faith? What saves us? The Lord's power or faith? Can you be saved without faith? No. Is it faith that saves you? No. It's God's power that saves us. What's the difference? Power is the source. Faith is the agency. His power, and he wants to make it very clear, that when I say your faith, I mean your faith as a hand taking something is that which has saved you, not anything else. Now, the response of the woman, verse 47. When the woman saw that she had not escaped notice, she came. Came implies what? Came back, doesn't it? She was there. Now she comes back. So the woman came back. She had started her exit, shaking, and fell down before him and declared in the presence of all the people the reason why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." Why do you think she shook? You can give several reasons. Number one, she was speaking to a man, and you didn't do that. Number two, she was speaking to a man in public, and you certainly don't do that. The action of an unclean person reaching out and touching another person and making them unclean, is that worthy of criticism? You bet it is. She had done what she was not supposed to do. What went through her mind? Is he going to scold me? Or what else might have gone through her mind if she'd acted improperly? What would you? Is he going to reverse it all? Or not? So all that added up to her shaking. Now, let's take the last 5 minutes and try to make some good observations. Number one, the crowd does not understand your faith. The crowd does not understand your faith. The Lord does. Nobody there understood her faith and her touch. The Lord did. Two, Jesus always treated interruptions as opportunities. Always. He always treated interruptions as opportunities. As a matter of fact, he never, and let me give you four instances where Jesus was interrupted, and these were occasions. Jesus was interrupted while teaching. Jesus was interrupted while sleeping. Jesus was interrupted while praying. Jesus was interrupted while traveling. Let me give you a passage. Luke, while teaching, Luke 5, 17 through 20. While sleeping, Luke 8, 22 through 24. While praying, Mark 1, 35 through 39. While traveling, Mark 10, 46, 49. And we ought to put et al after all of that, and meaning many other instances. So we can establish that he was interrupted. Now, a third point. Each interruption was used as a springboard. Each interruption was a springboard. And in every case, it was a springboard for one of two things. Springboard for teaching a great truth. Or B, performing a great work. Or can we put it this way? An interruption for us is a painful exigency. A interruption for Jesus was always a golden opportunity. He knew none. He never rebuked anyone for interrupting. He didn't turn around to the woman and say, I'm in a hurry. I'm sleeping. Can't you even let me pray in peace? I'm traveling and I'm late. Never was that the case. He regarded as every event that came into his life as from the hand of his Father. And that's how he developed a bleeding stomach. That's why he was so stressed out. He never saw an interruption. It was always a means. It was always God breaking in and saying, I know you're asleep, but wake up for a minute. I've got something for you to do. And he did it happily and cheerfully. Or it was, I know you're traveling, but come on over here for a while. I know you're on a way to an emergency call because the girl is dying, and I know this is a big deal and you've got to get there, but just hang on a minute. There's something on the way that I need for you to do. I need you to take care of this woman. And the Lord never replied by saying, oh, that makes me nervous. I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to get there. I'm late. And isn't that the way we live life? You know, just terror from one thing to another. And God help us if anybody gets in my way on the road. Or your way on the road. And thus we live under stress. And I think a great lesson here from the life of Jesus concerning that. Okay, coming off of that then. Each interruption was a springboard for teaching a great truth or performing a great work. Number four, observation. Jesus was never flustered. Jesus was never flustered, ever. An interruption never bothered him. He was never at loss of what to say or what to do. Can you point anywhere where the Lord says, "You come"? I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to react. That was never, ever the case. Now, this will become important, because notice back here that you have these great crowds following him. But who does the Lord deal with? Jairus, a lady with a problem, and his daughter. And I think we can make an observation. Jesus' concern was never the crowd. His concern was never the crowd, but the individual. There were masses of people around him, but he dealt with Jairus, an individual. He focused on his daughter, an individual. He focused on the woman with the problem. Jesus' concern was never the crowd, but always the individual. And a sixth observation, I think we all know it. We can make it off of verse 42. This girl was 12. Death does not respect age. She was only 12. But she was dying. Seventh, true faith. True faith is always perceived by the Lord. True faith is always perceived by the Lord. She didn't even say anything to him. She didn't need to. Now, the next lesson we'll make a little bit really comes into the, well, let's put it down. 8. Jesus always deals with people, with believing people, in a way that further develops faith. Jesus deals with those who believe in a way that increases their faith, or in a manner that increases faith. Now this will come especially when Jairus said, "Come and heal my daughter." The Lord could have spoken a word, said, "Go home, she's healed." He could have said, "Jairus, take my hand." And he could have been Batman over the crowd and arrived at the place in that way. But he didn't. The man who came believing that his daughter could be healed, Jesus, what way did he treat with him? He let her die. So that faith that he had would get bigger. And that's saying that often the Lord lets things get worse so we'll grow more. Or have you ever found anything like that strange thing happening? That I took the problem to the Lord and he didn't do anything until it was too late. He let me have a little problem, and now I got a big problem. And that adds one last remark we might make, is in this context, Jesus allowed a lesser problem to become a greater problem to better display his power. Do you think he might ever do such a thing as that? Would he let a lesser problem become a greater problem so his greater power can be exhibited? That's exactly the way Paul interpreted his thorn in the flesh, wasn't it? "This thorn in the flesh was given to me so the sufficiency of his grace might be known." Hope the computer gets fixed. I think I lost several points there, but nonetheless. Tremendous lesson, I think, involved in the healing of this woman. Well, now, in our next study, we will arrive and the girl will be dead, and we'll see the miracle that concludes and is intertwined with this one completed in the chapter. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word in Christ's name. Amen.